You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, June 11th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Make it so.
Why do you say that, Evan?
I don't know. Why do I say that?
Well, maybe it's because today is Captain Picard Day, apparently.
For real? Captain Picard Day? Who decided that?
Apparently someone on Evan's Facebook page decided it.
Yeah, they did. sent me the link and everything.
Ensign Crusher.
Apparently there is a Star Trek episode, and Captain Picard Day is a thing on the episode. And it was on Stardate 47457.1, which apparently matches up with June 16th. But apparently there are also other opinions about what that date would be, like November 4th or January 8th or January 10th. So I see this a lot like
throw a dart at a dartboard.
A lot like how the creation of the universe happened on October 23rd, you know, and exactly, you know, which year that was. It depends on how you read the texts, basically. Mm-hmm. But apparently some geeks think that today is Captain Picard Day.
It's a geeky form of numerology.
Is there a specific formula for a star date conversion?
There can be, but it varies between various series and movies. So, just don't use it.
It depends if you're the People's Front of the Federation or the Federation's Front for the People. I mean, it really depends.
The Front for the People of the Federation.
Yeah, it depends on which you ascribe to.
And you know, you wonder why Leonard Nimoy is not doing conventions anymore.
But what's supposed to happen on Captain Picard Day?
Well, you talk about how awesome Captain Picard is.
I mean, you basically put on the British accent, telling people to engage, to disengage.
Make it so.
Wesley, you know,
you tell Worf he's wrong.
But apparently, in the Star Trek episode, the Next Gen episode, on Captain Picard Day, you're supposed to host school children and show them what Starfleet is like. So we could turn this into a science, you know, skeptical thing, and we could say on Captain Picard Day, we teach school children about science and skepticism.
We do that all the time, though.
Yeah, I mean, we do that every week, Steve.
Every day is Captain Picard Day.
It sort of is. School children, though, you know, specifically.
Well, Jay, tell us about LIDAR and the City of Gold.
Have you guys ever heard of Hernando Cortez?
Cortez.
Not Juan Valdez.
No.
Hernando Cortez.
Does he make you think of anything? Like, does the last name Cortez remind you of gold, maybe?
Cortez is gold from Pirates of the Caribbean.
No. Right.
The first movie.
No, that's... I'm sure
is that where our history of Spanish conquistadors comes from?
Yeah, you have to watch Pirates of the Caribbean. No, but this guy, back in the 1500s, he was trying to locate this place where there was supposed to be a lot of gold. It was like an ancient ruin that he was looking for. And that ruin actually is in the Mosquitia region of Honduras, and it's called the Lost City of Ciudad Blanca. Wow.
The White City.
The White City.
City, right.
The White City, Blanca.
Anybody that can speak Spanish will know that I pronounced that horribly wrong. So what happened was, I guess he was looking in the right continent, but he didn't know exactly where it was. And the way that they were exploring back then, you know, with the machete, going through the woods, walking through the woods. Well, that's basically the same way that a lot of archaeologists would hunt around in areas like that today. And of course, that costs a ton of money. There's dangers involved. There's health dangers. There's, you know, physical dangers involved in doing that kind of legwork. So what happened was a company came out with a very interesting and very effective way of being able to look at the terrain that's underneath all of the green growth that most of these regions are completely covered in. So the technique they used is called LIDAR, and that means light detection and ranging. The technology is being used to do things like, well, they're saying that they would be able to use this technology to map disaster areas or track erosion that's under rivers and shallow parts of the ocean. And of course, the potential for military spying is there as well. For now, though, the archaeologists have their hands on it, and other than them, like I said, exploring with machetes and whatnot, you know, this just is very fast and it's very safe to use. Of course, they're flying over in an airplane. And what they do is they shoot billions of lasers over whatever, like, you know, of course, depending on the size of the acres that they're covering, they would be using a lot more, but they shoot like about, I think, 100,000 laser beams a second at the ground.
And, you know, Jay, they could use that technique to map underwater ruins, and they could mount the lasers on the top of sharks' heads.
That's right. And these would actually be frickin' laser beams.
They would be frickin' laser beams.
Which would be awesome.
It's like a dream come true.
So they shoot the laser beams at the ground, and some of the light bounces back, and they can tell how the distance by how long it takes, and you understand how that works. They can get it down to like about 4 inches or 10 centimeters, which is really accurate for this type of technology. It's probably a lot more accurate than they need it to even be to get a good reading out of it. Now, this isn't the first time that it's been used successfully. They also used it in 2009 when a team was working on Mayan ruins, and they actually successfully used it, and in proof of concept, it worked very well. And now they're using it on this location. They actually think they found the ruins, and I guess now they send in a crew to get in there and, you know, do it on foot. But now they know exactly where they're going. So no gold has been found yet or anything, but proof of concept. It's a fantastic technology. It's very fast. I mean, they flew over the location for 2 days, and very soon after that, when they uploaded the data into the machine, it was like, yep, and here's the ruins, and here's the topography. Very accurate and incredibly cost effective. So they're going to be using this a lot more. And they're actually the company that's behind the whole thing is dumping a lot of time and energy into doing research in other areas, like I mentioned before, about other applications.
Interesting. You know, LIDAR is also the name for the animal that's a combination lion and tidar.
Lion and tidar.
That was a funnier,
boy.
That was a funnier joke in my head.
Yes. One would hope.
I've been sitting on that joke for the last 5 minutes giggling to myself, and it didn't live up to the hype once I said it out loud. Sorry.
But you do always need to, when you use any kind of like aerial mapping to identify potential locations, you do need to then confirm it on the ground. There's just no way around that.
That's true.
You know, you don't have to be hunting through the jungle, Indiana Jones style, with a whip and a couple of six shooters.
That is the most stylish way to do it, but
yeah,
it is. Yep.
A lot of people
die. And a full
die.
Orchestra accompaniment, lots of music.
Have any of you guys seen Prometheus yet? The
no.
Aliens prequel?
I have not.
Did you?
Not yet.
I want to
no
see
spoilers.
It. I did.
You did? How was it?
Wait. tell us if it was good. Come on.
I'm hearing mixed reviews.
It was all right. It was not epic.
Ah,
that's a huge
epic.
Disappointment.
The coolest thing about the movie was it featured LIDAR. They had these little devices that would zip around shooting lasers all over the place and 3D mapping the place that they were exploring. It was, you know, LIDAR 100 years from now, basically. That was, I think, the coolest thing that in the whole movie.
That's sad.
Really?
That's the coolest thing in the movie.
It
cooler
is.
Than that ship?
It is kind of sad, yeah. Well.
All right, well, Bob, tell us about even more information now about even more extremophile bacteria.
Extremophiles.
Well,
sounds extreme.
Yet
we
again.
We should have like a theme song for the extremophiles that's just electric guitars. Like 10 electric guitars.
Ten.
At least.
One
of our listeners will surely work on that.
It's got to be extreme.
Yeah.
Well, that is. Yeah.
That would be a neat hard rock band, the Extremophiles.
Extremophiles.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Hell yeah.
I like it.
I don't like it.
What are you talking about?
Well, they can only play, you know, specific venues. They can't go everywhere.
They only play on the rim of a volcano.
Does that remind anybody of the band from Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide? The ones that, was it Blackheart Desiarto? What was his name? He actually used nuclear reactors for his speaker system or something. I mean, if you weren't miles Douglas. Away when they were doing their sound check, you literally, your head would explode or something like that.
Anyway, what were we talking about?
Okay, well, yet again, lowly microbes show that they are in some ways cooler life forms than mere human beings. Scientists they're studying soil microbes in a desiccated, inhospitable environment on the slopes of volcanoes have found a branch of life that inexplicably is able to survive. This, of course, begs the question, can they survive on Mars? A lot of people are talking about it, or have similar organisms existed there in the past or even now? So what happened was a team of scientists from the University of Colorado Boulder analyzed the DNA found in soil samples on rocky volcanic slopes in South America, and they found microbes surviving where literally none other could. These aren't ordinary microbes or bacteria. Of course, these are extremophiles, and they're representatives of one of the three top domains of life called archaea. So what the hell is that? You guys have played 20 questions, right? What's the first question in the inevitable?
Animal, vegetable, or archaea.
Yeah. Right. Animal, vegetable, or mineral. And so why do you ask that first? Well, it's because those three things are the three top categories that kind of encompass everything or almost everything that you encounter or know about. But so from a purely biological point of view, if you asked that question a few decades ago, what you'd say is Monera, Protista, a fungi, planti, or Animalia. I mean, it's taking the animal and vegetable and kind of like that's how biologists would look at it. Those are the major categories. So they were the categories or kingdoms that covered every living thing, and that's considered wrong today. Monera, which was the first one I mentioned, that included single-celled organisms with no cell nucleus. These are prokaryotes. You might have heard that term thrown around. And so that includes regular bacteria and these bizarre guys called archaea. But once they really could start looking at the genes and really take a close look at these guys, they realized that the diversity within this Monera kingdom was just way too huge for one group to encompass it. So the microbiologist Carl Woese, I think that's how you pronounce his name, he took a step back and said, wait, we've got to rearrange this stuff. He said that these archaea they're fundamentally a different sort of life. So he created, instead of kingdoms, he took one step up and created these domains. So all life are encompassed by these three categories. They've got bacteria, which we know about. You've got the archaea, and you've got the eukaryotes, which is pretty much multicellular life, animals, everything else. So what makes these guys special is that they use one of the things, because there's lots of things that are very different about them, but they use a far greater range of sources of energy than any other organism. Most organisms use things like common sugar, but they, archaea, can use things like ammonia, metal ions, or even hydrogen gas. Archaea are found in plankton. They are considered by some to be the most abundant groups of organisms on the planet because of that. So when you take a close look at this environment that they found them in, it's pretty nasty. It's at a pretty high altitude, about almost 20,000 feet. Because of that, the UV levels are twice what you'd find in a typical desert. It's been ice free for 48,000 years, no ice at all. When it does snow, the snow sublimates right back into the atmosphere really fast. Pretty much soon after it hits the ground, bam, it's back. It's evaporated. And the soil nutrients are so depleted that when they tried to detect the nitrogen levels, they couldn't detect anything. It was below the limits of detection. So like no nitrogen in the soil. Pretty incredible. And then the temperatures, while the scientists were there, the scientists took temperature readings, and the temperature ranged from 14 degrees Fahrenheit one night and spiked to 133 degrees Fahrenheit the next day. So it's amazing, amazing temperature range. And even, you know how there's organisms that can pretty much rain down in the atmosphere. Even don't they think that bacteria now can be nucleation sites for the formation of raindrops and clouds and things? You can have these organisms kind of raining down into your environment, and they don't even survive. If they rain down in this environment, they like pretty much die immediately. So yes, yeah, a pretty forbidding environment, needless to say. So they looked at these guys and they said, well, how do they survive? They checked it to see if they use photosynthesis, probably one of the first things you'd look at, and they don't have what it takes to accomplish that. So we don't know yet actually how these guys how they create energy, but the prevailing theory is that they must use some sort of like a chemical reaction that pulls energy from this carbon monoxide and dimethyl sulfide that the wind kind of blows in. But they're still not sure exactly how they're doing this, and that theory might be totally wrong. But the one thing that all these news sites are talking about with this news item is the Mars tie-in. Everyone's talking about it. The scientists are actually working with astrobiologists to compare the current and past climates on Mars to these volcanic environments. Professor Steve Schmidt said that if we know on Earth what the outer limits of life were, and they know what the paleoclimates on Mars were like, we may have a better idea of what could have lived there. But so by learning more about these organisms, it could actually give some insight into what could have or what may exist on Mars. So in the future, with this discovery, the scientists, obviously, they want to set up an incubator that duplicates the extreme environment that they evolved in, and who knows, you know, who knows what they may learn in terms of you know, an undiscovered method of energy conversion that we could potentially even tap into for our own nefarious purposes. It's pretty cool. So check it out on online if you want to get more details. It was very interesting stuff.
Is there any place on Earth that is as foreboding as Mars is right now, where if we found extremophiles living there, we could say these critters could live on Mars?
You know, I didn't find any definitive statements, but this environment that I just talked about, if you think about it, it's got a thin atmosphere, it's got lots of UV, but it's got a lot of what Mars has. I mean, I think this is actually the closest environment to Mars that exists on Earth, a natural environment. So I would guess that these organisms could stick it out on Mars if they could make it here.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think you'll find a closer analog.
Yeah, that's cool. All right. Well, we are going to move from these unicellular creatures to people so that Rebecca can tell us, well, are we moral when our behavior is anonymous?
Yes. Ooh. There is a new study out. You guys will be happy to know that researchers have, in fact, discovered deep and inarguable new truths about morality and the human condition. No, just kidding. There is, though, a weird new study that a lot of people will probably interpret in whatever way they want, as is common with these sorts of psych studies. But this one is about the dictator game, which is a well-loved study that we've probably talked about before on this show, and that many of our listeners have probably read about in pop psychology books like Freakonomics. And in the dictator game, there are two players. One gets an amount of money, say 50 cents, and that person has the opportunity to give any amount of their money to the second player. And that's pretty much it. That's the basic idea of the dictator game.
Is it real money?
Yes. Yeah, they always work with real money because they're looking to see how moral people are, or how benevolent people are.
Right.
And a lot of these studies revolve around how benevolent people are, whether they're being watched, whether they're in public, whether there's some sort of social expectation for them to be benevolent. So there are a lot of variations on that basic dictator game. For instance, there's one popular one in which the second player has the opportunity to refuse the money, which would mean both parties lose all their money. You know, there's more complicated things like that. But the study we're talking about today is more like the original dictator game, in which the second player has no say. And this study, done by researchers at the University College London and Switzerland's Université de Neuchâtel, I probably butchered that, sorry. This study was meant to replicate the findings of previous studies that showed that the first player is more likely to give a larger portion of money if they're being watched. And in fact, they're more likely to give a larger portion of money even if they're only seeing a picture of eyes. So for instance, one past study, it's weird. One past study had people paying any price they wanted for a cup of coffee, and there was no one else around. And they found that people paid more money when there was just a picture of eyes posted on the coffee machine, as opposed to, you know, a picture of anything else. So this study was looking to replicate those findings, but we're doing it online. They're using a service called Amazon's Mechanical Turk, which is an online market where people can do simple tasks for small payments. So they had people on this service represent the players in the dictator game. And so the first player would get 50 cents, and then they had the choice of sharing as much or as little of their 50 cents with a second player as they wanted. And both players in the situation were completely anonymous. And what they found was that people tended to be more generous online in general than they did in the previous studies that had been done in person. They also found that showing someone a pair of eyes in this test, so let me just sort of describe for you what it looked like. they the first player gets to they see a little picture, and beneath the picture it says, I will keep the following amount, I will allocate the following amount to receiver, and they can fill in those blanks. And in some of the tests the picture was a pair of eyes, and in other tests they were flowers, and in other tests they were just like a solid color or something like that. And so what they found was that the eyes in this case had no difference. People gave the same amount whether it was eyes or whether it was just a solid color. Though they did find that flowers had a positive impact on the amount of money that the first player gave. That's basically what the study found. And from there, people are now taking that and, you know, extrapolating it in any way they please. And I really enjoyed, I read about this on Wired's site, which is usually, Wired is usually quite good, I find, but, this made me laugh. Here we go. In another interesting observation, Rehani and Bashari, those are the researchers, Rehani and Bashari's dictators gave away 19 cents when shown flowers on the decision screen, hinting at the possible generosity nourishing effects of nature. Really? That hints at the,
bowls,
the possible generosity nourishing effect of nature. You know, at least it then ends with one of the researchers saying that we just don't know enough yet to say about anything.
But Wired, but Wired does.
Yeah.
Wired said it anyways.
I mean, I think looking at this whole tight area of research, you know, we come away with a couple of conclusions. One is that it's really hard to interpret this research. There's just so many variables. I know we've talked about this before, that, you know, unless you're really triangulating among many, many studies and you're really isolating a specific variable, it's hard to say, like, yeah, really, the nurturing effect of nature, that's, you're going to make that massive leap from this one tiny bit of information. But I do think, though, that one signal that is here in this type of research is that people have this subconscious moral calculus that we, you know, apparently evolved to make that is really easily manipulated. You know, like just having a picture of eyes there alters that calculus for us in a subconscious way. But what's interesting is that most people will cheat a little bit. Most people are, in fact, cheaters, but only a little bit. And it's as if the moral calculus is, I'm going to get away with a little bit so that I have an edge, but not so much that I'm going to sacrifice my standing in the community as an honest person.
Mm. Or get caught.
Yeah.
I want to mention that the idea that people give more when they see pictures of eyes wasn't really rebutted by this study, but, you know, because this study showed that there was no difference when people looked at a pair of eyes. But it might point towards the sort of dehumanizing sort of anonymity of the internet, having an effect on how much people
get.
So again, they saw an effect, but there's just not enough data to really draw a conclusion about what that means. But that's one possible interpretation. And also, I wanted to say that I was looking at various dictator game studies, and my favorite one that I found is titled The Dictator Game, Fairness and Ethnicity in Post-War Bosnia. And researchers actually, it was very interesting. They used the dictator game as a way to determine whether or not people in a post-war region were able to overcome that sort of violence and separation in order to get back to a base level of benevolence between one another. And, you know, what this study showed was that they could. And they did study 681 Muslims, Croats, and Serbs in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And, yeah, they found that they tended to be just as benevolent as people in other areas. So I found it interesting how far and wide this kind of study can be applied.
All right, well, let's move on. There was a recent article published in the BMJ, the British Medical Journal, that warns people against spinal manipulation.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to see a mainstream article taking a look at a controversial alternative, quote-unquote, modality and and concluding that it is not advisable. So for background, neck manipulation is done mostly by chiropractors, not entirely. Some physical therapists or sports medicine practitioners will, or osteopaths will, do some neck manipulation. And when we say, use the term manipulation, we're referring to some high velocity maneuvers of the neck. So not just any movement of the neck, because there's also another term called neck mobilization, which is much gentler, and it's just an attempt to free maybe some locked or frozen joints in the neck. You know, if the neck joints are in a bad position and it's stuck and it needs to be mobilized, that's a different thing than a chiropractic neck manipulation, which is a little more violent. And chiropractors do this for all sorts of indications, including neck pain and migraines and headache. The controversy that's been surrounding cervical manipulation or neck manipulation has been that it appears to be a risk factor for arterial dissection or small tears in one of the arteries going to the brain, the vertebral or the carotid arteries. And when that occurs, blood clots can form on the tear on the inside of the artery, and then that blood clot can break off, go downstream, lodge, and cause a stroke. There's no question in the literature and the studies that have been done that there is a correlation between chiropractic neck manipulation, or just neck manipulation in general, and the occurrence of strokes. The chiropractors, however, claim that, well, yeah, there's a correlation, but that doesn't prove causation. And in fact, what's happening is that people who are having neck pain because they already had a dissection are seeking out a chiropractor for treatment of that neck pain. The thing that's ironic about that is that that's, first of all, they don't know that that's true, and that's hardly a defense, because you shouldn't manipulate a neck that has a dissection, you know, so that's a contraindication. So they're basically saying we're misdiagnosing carotid dissection or arterial dissection and inappropriately treating it, you know, hardly a defense. But in any case, it's also, what's not controversial is that the actual incidence of strokes is very low. No one is saying that this happens all the time. The estimated vertebral dissection resulting from neck manipulation is somewhere between 1 in 400,000 manipulations to 1 in 5.8 million manipulations, although that higher figure is certainly an underestimate, because that's based upon litigation records, so not clinical cases, not any kind of, you know, systematic survey. Probably the 1 in 400,000 figure is a little bit closer to the truth, and it may even be lower than that. Again, this is generally underreported and underappreciated. And because of the numbers involved, I mean, you could never do an experimental study. You know, you couldn't randomize people to getting neck manipulation or not getting manipulation and see how many get dissection. That's unethical and impractical. So we have to go on epidemiological data, which will tend to underestimate these numbers. But let's go with the 1 in 400,000 figure. Also, that's manipulations, not patients. So if an average patient gets manipulated 10 times, you know, that's 1 in 40,000 patients who get manipulated, just using the 1 in 10 as a representative figure. But the real question is, and I think that the BMJ article did a good job of bringing this to the forefront, is, you know, how we think about things in medicine is risk versus benefit. I know I've said that before on this show. You can't just consider risk, and you have to consider the risk versus the benefit. There are certainly lots of medical procedures that we recommend that have complication rates on the same order of magnitude or greater. But when the benefit is far greater still, then it justifies that risk. I often use chemotherapy as the example. Chemotherapy is horribly toxic and causes damage. But the benefits of chemotherapy in terms of improved survival outweigh the risks of the toxicity of the chemotherapy itself. So what the BMJ article, you know, did is they reviewed the literature on the risk. It's low, but it seems to be there. There's evidence to show the causal effect, you know, people who are fine and then very soon after getting their neck manipulated, having a stroke from a dissection. You know, so there's a pretty clear temporal sequence there. And And also, this can happen in otherwise young and healthy individuals. It's not like an 80-year-old who's at a high risk for stroke anyway. We're talking about a 30-year-old, you know, suddenly having a dissection and a stroke, which could not only could be neurologically devastating, but could lead to death. So even though it's not uncommon, you have to consider that the outcome, stroke and death, is extremely bad. And so we're much less tolerant of major or serious adverse events. So what's on the other side of the equation? What is the benefit of spinal manipulation for neck pain and headaches? Well, it turns out it's not there at all, that there's really no evidence to support that cervical manipulation is superior to more benign or less invasive interventions like mobilization, as I mentioned, or just massage, something really benign like just, you know, a basic neck massage. Not deep massage that, or anything that would be a risk also to damage to the delicate tissues of the neck, but just, you know, a superficial massage. So it's not superior to, and it's much more risky than these more benign procedures. That's pretty much it. That's the death knell for any medical intervention. It's more dangerous and not better than some other alternative. Then what's the reason for using it instead of the other alternative? There isn't any. It becomes completely unethical. I don't even buy that there's really significant benefit from any of these things. I mean, I think that although most of the data is like comparing them, but not really comparing them to placebo. So they don't really establish that any of them are more effective placebo, but they say that, okay, yeah, manipulation and mobilization and massage are all about the same in terms of their effect. One study that I looked at recently compared it to kinesiotaping, which is essentially just applying this specific kind of tape to the affected muscles. That was as effective as neck manipulation. But again, neither compared to placebo, so we don't know that either was effective at all. Probably is a mild temporary benefit. But there doesn't appear to be any increased benefit to doing this high velocity, you know, more dangerous neck manipulation. So the BMJ article concluded, and I completely agree with the conclusion, that it's therefore inadvisable. I mean, I would go as far as it's actually unethical. It doesn't make medical sense. Of course, the chiropractors are responding defensively. Remember the British Chiropractic Association?
Oh, yeah.
Association, yeah, that went after Simon Singh.
Simon. Yep.
For daring to say that their treatments don't have any evidentiary basis. So their comment was, the cherry-picking of poor-quality research needlessly raises alarm in patients and does little to help the people suffering from neck pain and headaches to choose the most appropriate treatment. So guys want to pick out a logical fallacy or two in there?
Yeah, it's the logical fallacy of bullshit.
Yeah, well, it's definitely bullshit. So there's a begging the question in there. Because it says, it mentions it does little to help people suffering from neck pain. That's sort of begging the question that they help people with neck pain, or that this option that they're talking about of manipulation is of any benefit to neck pain. That has not been established. What's interesting as well is that they talk about cherry picking, when in fact the BMJ article reviewed systematic reviews. Systematic reviews are the exact opposite of cherry picking, right? They're systematic. So it's funny. I mean, it's funny that what I've noticed a lot, just as a little aside, it's a little skeptical aside, writing about these topics a lot, that the other side is starting to borrow and steal a lot of skeptical lingo.
Yeah.
You know, and then throwing it back at us. It's like they feel like if they just steal our language, that they're putting themselves on equal footing.
That's par for the course. So
I don't remember him using the term cherry picking much in the past.
Yeah, but I'm getting that thrown. Oh, you're cherry picking data. It's like, hello, this is a systematic review. And I've had people accuse me of cherry picking when I was citing, referencing systematic reviews.
Yeah, but they don't even know what that is, Steve. They're just using the words because they think it empowers them.
Well, I think they're parroting skeptical language because it's been out there so much on the internet. You know, in a way it's a bit of a compliment. I honestly think that, but they don't understand how to actually use the critical thinking that's behind the terminology. They're just using it because that has the form of skeptical argument. You know,
it's exactly like creationists using the term theory as though you know what it means.
Yeah, exactly. It is.
Right.
It is. Interesting. So this is the same thing. Yeah, Pseudologic. The British Chiropractic Association is doing the same thing. But they're wrong. This, you know, there have been several systematic reviews that show there's lack of superiority and there's growing evidence for risk. So some risk, no benefit, not a good calculation.
Nope.
And the response of the chiropractic community, in my opinion, is a good example of why they are not a science-based profession. Not that there's never any defensiveness or wrongness in how mainstream medicine responds to new information. There often is, but they're intransigent. I mean, this has been going on for years, and they keep accusing anyone, rather than saying, this is a very important issue, we need to study this carefully to make sure that we're not causing strokes in young people, rather than saying that it's all defensiveness and this is an attack on chiropractic and this is bad for chiropractic, and they've been that way for years, so they're not really giving any ground. And that's because they're stuck in neutral. They are not science or evidence based. You know, science is a way to justify their profession, not to ask or answer the hard questions. But anyway, so good BMJ article. I was very happy to see that. Evan, on a lighter note, we're going to end the news segment on a lighter note. You're going to tell us about Well, it's not really a lighter note.
No, it's not.
It does involve some rather tragic deaths. But why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah. Yep,
happy death.
Science kills, paranormal can, well, I don't know.
Hey, come on.
Let's see. We talk quite a bit on the show about the very dangerous nature of pseudoscience and belief in the paranormal. And in a lot of these cases, we talk about how people become ill or die as a result of either being deceived by others or deceived by their own lack of critical thinking. And this week's particular case involves the death of two girls who died as a result of believing in ghosts based on a local urban legend. So last week, a group of high school kids from Poplar Bluff, Missouri, packed into a Jeep Grand Cherokee one night, and they drove off to a place called Wilcox Road in town, and it's specifically where Wilcox Road intersects with the train tracks that run through town. And they were out playing a game called Ghost Train.
Oh,
and
boy.
The idea of this game is that you drive up and pull onto the train tracks, and then you turn off the engine, and you sit there, and you let the windows fog up. And it becomes, you know, very scary at night. The windows fog up. You can't quite see what's going on. You try your best to kind of just scare the crap out of yourself in that situation. Because, according to a website called StrangeUSA.com, this particular ghost story in this town describes the tale of a train derailment that occurred right at that intersection roughly 100 years ago, which killed everyone on board.
Whoa.
And it was said a man was decapitated. He became an acranate, Bob. but authorities never found his head. And another tale has it that a pregnant woman's body was recovered, but the baby was missing from her womb.
What?
Sounds apocryphal.
Other people talk, or people who played this game report they can hear a train whistle in the background. It gets louder and louder, and then all of a sudden stops. Or they'll see a light when they're looking down the train tracks, and suddenly it disappears.
It's funny how we had the exact same ghost story about the train tracks in my small town growing up.
Yeah. Yeah, and
it's
again,
it's
urban,
a local
urban legends. Right. I mean,
yeah.
You have them all over your towns. The danger, the obvious danger of this one is that you're putting yourself in the line of potentially a train coming along. And unfortunately, that's exactly what happened this night. And when the five kids inside finally realized that, oh my gosh, there's a real train coming, they panicked.
We hear the ghost train. We hear the ghost train. It's coming.
You can see the light.
It's a real train, you guys. Get out.
So they couldn't get the car started. It had electrical problems, whatever. So the three of the kids managed to get out, but two of the girls, they panicked. They couldn't get. They were still locked in their seatbelts. They couldn't. You know, they were so upset. You know, they couldn't get out in time. And sure enough, they were in it. The train hit, and they are dead.
Wow.
One of the other kids who did get out, you know, they claimed to the authorities that they weren't there playing the game. You know, it's that, you know, that wasn't the reason. They said that the car just happened to stall out at that point and so forth. But other people who live in the area report that this happens a lot. You know, the urban legend has caught on, and that other kids, you know, on a regular basis are seen out there doing this exact thing.
If anything, you know, them getting killed would probably generate a lot of ghost stories.
A lot of ghost stories. And other people, it might lure, they're afraid it might lure more people out there to actually, you know, see if now if they can, you know, contact maybe the spirits of these two dead girls now who have died there. And so it's going to, it perpetuates the myth in a certain sense. And the ironic thing, guys, is that according to local authorities, that train derailment never happened 100 years ago. That itself is an
oh, my God, yeah. Not surprised.
Right? I mean, clearly about the guy that gets decapitated head and the woman's body and the pregnant and all that, right? But there was never a train derailment there to begin with. So it's just totally, totally made up. You know, kids doing what kids do, you know, telling ghost stories at night, trying to scare themselves. But, man, you know,
I don't think, Evan, that they necessarily believed the ghost story. We can't really conclude that. I mean, this is the kind of game that teenagers do, you know, just as on a dare or just something fun to do to spook each other, even if they don't believe it. You know, it's like playing with a Ouija board. You don't necessarily have to believe that, you know, the demons are moving the thing around. It's just a sort of a fun game, and you suspend disbelief. It was the tragedy here is that it was just stupid to park on the train tracks and let the windows fog up. I mean, that just don't do that as part of your game. You know, that was the tragic thing. So
somebody came up with the idea. Yeah, you know, we're going to park our car on the train tracks and we're going to let the windows fog up and we're going to wait. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. Really, guys? That's your idea?
Our town had that one, and also another one where there's an intersection in the middle of some woods, and the woods are supposed to be haunted, and you're supposed to go in your car as fast as you can at midnight and turn off your headlights and fly through the stoplight or the stop sign. And if you do it, you'll see a ghost. And kids do it. Like, it's so ridiculous, but... Yeah, you know, I guess
so. You always have to wonder: does the origin of the story is that let's see if we could get some people to do things really stupid and dangerous?
Let's see if we can kill some teenagers.
Yeah. So, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
I love this part of the show. Who's That Noisy? We get to play a little noise for you, and you have to guess exactly who or what or whom made that noise. So I'll play for
who
you.
Who made that noise?
Yes. Well, for those of us who are grammatically challenged, whom made that noise? Which is me and two other people. So last week's Who's That Noisy is, again, as follows.
And what it is, as your readers know, is that the sun is made of plasma. It's a fourth state of matter. So
is plasma really the fourth state of matter? There's a little argument on the message board.
Really?
About that. Well, they're saying that, you know.
Ionized gas?
Yeah, ionized gas, and therefore, can you really call it a fourth state of matter?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty... I mean, I've encountered that phrase over and over and over for years and years. So lots of people that I think are, you know what they're talking about, consider it the fourth state of matter. And the fact that it's a fourth, I guess, is meaningless because you could name them any way you want. But it's a distinct form of matter from what I could tell. I mean, I don't know what arguments they were making, but I'm kind of surprised that that would be there would be some controversy over that.
No controversy then. Okay. All right. Just want to make sure I didn't miss something, because that's what I understood it to be, the classic fourth state of matter. Well, since we've learned what plasma finally was. But who said that? I mean, whose voice is that? Anyone know John Linnell?
Of course.
They might be giants.
They might be giants, one half of the alternative rock duo.
But he taught me that the sun is a mass of incandescent gas.
He did tell you that. And actually, they borrowed that from a song prior to that, so they kind of remade that. Yeah. Let's see how it went. The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a giant nuclear furnace, where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions
of millions of degrees.
There you go. That's right.
The sun is hot. The sun is not a place where we can live.
And,
stop.
And it goes on. But, you know, they... realized that they have they had an album back in 2009 called Here Comes Science, and they wrote a bunch of songs, and they, with the help of some scientists, they ran their lyrics past them to make sure that they were being correct and technical with the science, as any good responsible patrons of science would be, and they decided that they have to make an amendment, or they had to redo the song to correctly state that it's not gas, that it's plasma. So they came up with the reversion of that song called Why Does the Sun Really Shine? The sun is a miasma of incandescent plasma. The sun's not simply made out of gas. No, no, no. The sun is a quagmire. It's not made of fire. Forget what you've been told in the past. Very clever. As always, yeah. You know, it's one of the most clever bands in history, and they are wonderful. They are excellent stewards of science, popularizing science to the masses and to children as well through their music. So I've been a fan.
What was their song, Mr. Worm? Remember that one?
Dr. Worm.
Dr. Worm.
Sounds right.
It's awesome. Now, we had a couple, couple people guess correctly. The first one to guess correctly, specifically with that name, was ALH from the message boards, who said that that was John Linnell from They Might Be Giants. And he even pulled out the exact interview that I pulled that clip from. It was an interview with Astronomy Magazine as they were promoting their album.
Good work. Good sleuthing.
Well done.
So what do you got for this week, Evan?
Without further delay, here we go with a brand new, fresh off the presses, Who's That Noise?
That's the noise people make when they get a puppy.
that's a little creepy, actually.
All right. I'm going to make a guess that that is some type of non-humanoid animal making really funny, cute noises, potentially maybe a bird.
Well, you might be onto something, Jay, but you might not be, or you may have, you know, one or two little bits in there that are incorrect. But we'll leave it to our listeners to come up
with. One or two bits. I only had two bits in there.
Other than that, it was perfect. info@theskepticsguide.org is our email address. So go ahead and send us your answers there. Or you can post them right on our forums, on our message boards, sguforums.com, under podcast episodes, podcast episode 361 specifically. And good luck, everyone.
All right. Thanks, Evan. Got an email here from Tony Mikkel from Stuttgart, Germany. Sorry if I did not pronounce that correctly.
Stuttgart.
Awesome.
Isn't that where they make Porsches?
Is that right?
I think the Porsche factory is there, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Oh, I'd love to go there.
He writes, I want to address a topic of utmost importance, the medical credibility lent to non-physicians. Pretty much all German pharmacies sell homeopathic remedies. After gathering a relatively big amount of information about current studies and so on, I wanted to confront some local pharmacists. How to justify selling what obviously doesn't work. The responses were unexpected, to say the least. I went to four pharmacies stating that I'm interested to learn about homeopathy, setting up a little trap, hoping to get the everyday response to a question like that. All four pharmacists I talked to assured me enthusiastically that homeopathy certainly works and that it's a great way to go. They were clear that there is not the least doubt about the effectiveness. I was even told that homeopathy was, in fact, real medicine and shall not be confused with nutritional supplements. When confronted with the studies, they avoided to address any argument I made. Instead, their responses became, ironically enough, some kind of liquid. I heard some arguments from ignorance, some false dichotomies, and constantly moving the goalpost. I don't know about pharmacists in the U.S., but in Germany, they have almost the same credibility as physicians. They sell a big variety of non-homeopathic, actually real medicine on their own judgment and even tell people what dosage to take. Physicians usually only get consulted by Germans if the state of health appears to be somewhat critical. Most medicine is sold purely on the pharmacist's judgment. Today I discovered how full of crap they really are. I would love to hear your opinions on the topic, especially regarding the potential risk of people selling medicine while basically believing in magic. So, thank you, Tony. That's very interesting. I wasn't aware that pharmacists had independent prescribing power.
Wow.
That's interesting.
It sounds dangerous.
That's too powerful.
About it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what the regulations are in Germany, but pharmacists do, of course, get an education. But I don't know. They're not doctors. And, I think a very good argument could be made about how they're not really educated enough to make those types of calls.
Well, I'll tell you, my personal opinion, just this is pharmacists in the U.S., they're obviously very educated and knowledgeable about pharmacology. I mean, I think your average pharmacologist may, in fact, know more about pharmacology than your average doctor. And they're extremely useful. But knowing about the drugs is not the same as being able to practice clinical medicine. So there's an entire skill set that pharmacists are not taught. And You know, so that's why I think independently prescribing medication, you know, it depends on where you're drawing the line. If you think about it, we have over-the-counter medication. People could actually prescribe themselves medication as long as it's over-the-counter. So could there be another layer of medications that can be purchased with a pharmacist's consultation that doesn't require a medical consultation? That's not entirely unreasonable.
Well, we kind of almost have that in the U.S. because of Plan B. Plan B is a medication that is technically sold over-the-counter, but it's kept behind the pharmacist's desk, and you have to ask them for it. And a pharmacist in many states can refuse to give it to you based on religion.
Yeah, but that's all based on the whole abortion controversy.
Yeah, I mean, it's not – that's what I'm saying. We have it. But that's exactly what that is, though.
It creates the same situation because of that.
Yeah, it's become – yeah.
Yeah, so behind-the-counter, over-the-counter medications, you know, where you need a consultation with the pharmacist and they'll tell you about dosage and how to use it, and that's fine. But, you know, there are – I think you have to stop short of actually practicing medicine. Because that requires a knowledge and skill set that pharmacists don't have,
right?
But the other question here is, you know, what about pharmacists in Germany prescribing homeopathic potions and saying that they're the greatest thing since sliced bread? I mean, that's the disturbing bit here.
They're on the home turf of homeopathy.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, this is cultural. It's interesting. You know, homeopathy is very popular in Europe because it was invented there by Samuel Hahnemann. But what's disappointing is that Germany has a long and proud tradition of science, especially in the area of chemistry and things like that. I mean, they are, you know, a very rational people. And yet, just because of, again, the cultural history, there's also a huge amount of popularity to abject nonsense and magical potions. The compartmentalization is just incredible. You know, that these two things are existing side by side in the same culture, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what we see is that every culture has their particular brand of pseudoscience, and unfortunately that's Germany's.
Yep. Unfortunately, and for those two listeners who don't know what homeopathy is, the quickie is it's not as Tony says, it's not herbal remedies or nutritional supplements. It's magic water. It's you take water and you take some fanciful ingredient that has nothing to do with anything, and you dilute it into non-existence. So you end up with just the water that you started with, and that's it. That's what homeopathy is. It's a completely
– the water has memories.
Yeah, it's a totally fake magical potion, and it's amazing that it exists in our modern world. It really is an embarrassment to our species that it's still around. But this is just a particularly egregious example of it, and – you know, at least the United States isn't the worst at every pseudoscience. At least there are other parts of the country where that it can have.
Yeah,
at least there are other parts of the world that have their own pseudoscience. But that's a small consolation. There is a PS to this email. Tony writes, "The reason I learned about this podcast is my older brother, Andreas Mikkel. He is a really great guy and a big fan of your show for quite some years now. It would be totally incredible if you could greet him on the air. I probably wouldn't have to buy him birthday presents for the upcoming years." Well, thank you, Andreas, for getting your little brother involved in skepticism and the SGU. We always appreciate that sort of thing.
Sehr gut.
You can forward those birthday presents that would have been purchased straight to us.
That's true.
Yes.
All right. Hey, do you guys know – we're going to do a name not logical fallacy. Do you guys know what the congruence bias is?
No, I don't.
No.
Lots of
medias. Why haven't I heard
of this? So this is a good one. This is one that even otherwise well-informed skeptics may not be completely familiar with.
Clearly.
The congruence bias is the mistake of testing only your own theory for something. It can be very subtle, and again, it can take even otherwise critical thinking people by surprise. So in other words, you come up with some hypothesis, and we do this every day, and then you seek confirming evidence for that hypothesis. And when you find it, you go, aha, I was right. But what you don't do is test specifically to see if your hypothesis is wrong, and specifically you don't test other possible hypotheses. So let me give you an example from my own practice, from medicine. Because this doctors can fall for this all the time. So let's say that I notice, hey, you know, a lot of my patients who have migraines drink a lot of caffeine. So then I will ask the next 20 patients that I see with migraines what their caffeine intake, and lo and behold, most of them or all of them drink a lot of caffeine. So then I say, aha, caffeine worsens migraine headaches. That would be the congruence bias. What I really need to do is ask people who don't have migraines if they drink caffeine. And maybe they drink caffeine at the same rate as the patients with migraines. Or I need to ask my migraine patients if they have other lifestyle factors. And maybe there's something else. Maybe they have poor sleep or they eat watermelons. I don't know. There's something else that they could be consuming that also at the same rate. Maybe it's just that these are two things that are common in culture, you know, consuming caffeine and having migraines, and that have no specific correlation between them. Although I do think that caffeine worsens migraines, but I'm just using this as an example. So our natural tendency is to just test our own hypothesis, not competing hypotheses. So this leads to confirmation bias, right? So it's a form of confirmation bias, in fact, but it's a very subtle one because you think you're testing a hypothesis. The problem is you're just not testing all the plausible competing hypotheses. This is also related to something that Sherlock Holmes said, which is a really good quote I like. He said, and this is actually a quote that they pulled into the recent one of the recent Sherlock Holmes movies. He said, "It is a capital mistake to theorize before one has data. Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories instead of theories to suit facts."
How did Arthur Conan Doyle get it right in so many ways? I mean,
and yet,
it still get it wrong.
And yet
on
he believed
fairies.
In fairies
and ghosts.
It just seemed that
he understood critical thinking and rational and reason, and yet didn't employ it himself. That's the
refused to employ. Employ it.
So Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of Sherlock Holmes, was taken in by the Cottingley fairies. These two, young girls who took pictures of cardboard cutouts of fairies. And what's really interesting, I was watching the Antique Roadshow the other day. And this is the Antique Roadshow from, I think, Ireland. And the last bit they had on the show was two women, one fairly old and one middle-aged. And they had pictures of the two girls with the Cottingley fairies. And they were the original photographs. Hmm. Because the older woman was her daughter, was the daughter of one of those girls. And they had all these original Cottingley fairy photographs. It was unbelievable.
That's really cool.
Oh, gosh.
What were they worth?
We got to get it a hand.
Well, I mean, you couldn't price it. How could you put a price on those? They're priceless.
That's the point of the show, Steve.
I know, but sometimes they do say, listen, it's complete. They're worth whatever somebody thinks they're worth. You know what I mean? There's no comparison. They're unique historical items, you know. Sometimes they do say that. They might have thrown out a figure of 10 or 20,000 pounds or something. I don't know. But it was unbelievable. But what's really funny is, now, of course, all of these photographs, they also had a camera. They had a camera that Arthur Conan Doyle gave to one of the girls to help them take more pictures of fairies.
Cool.
And, of course, these photos were exposed as frauds. But the woman, the older woman, showed that there was one photo and said, "This photo is real. real fairies."
Oh, no.
They went back.
That's awesome.
And they really thought that they were real.
I wonder how that woman feels about raising such a credulous daughter. like how she would feel, I guess, if she was still alive. Like, oh God, really? You believed me when I told you that?
Imagine having such an iconic hoax in your family history. Wouldn't that be kind of? I think it'd be really cool and kind of embarrassing.
I guess that's how they rationalize it to themselves. But at the end, they got a real picture of fairies. And then she had some reason to, like, see how it looks a little different. You know, that's because it's real, you know. confirmation bias. A little congruence bias at that. She found a reason to find that the picture was real without testing other hypotheses. So, it was fascinating. It was fascinating to watch that. I was like, all right, well, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. I know you're going to love this. We have a theme this week with four items. Three of which, of course, are true. One is fake. The theme is Dutch astronomer Christian Huygens.
Wait a minute. There has to be a rule. If you can't say his name.
It's Christian Huygens, but I actually his name, I listened to the pronunciation of his name online, and if the internet is correct, it's Huygens. Huygens.
What the hell?
Now, I've never heard it that pronounced that way.
Remember on the Carol Burnett show, Steve, Lieutenant Huygens?
Lieutenant Huygens?
Yeah.
Or Professor Huygens? Whatever. So, yeah, but Christian Huygens, we'll just say. We'll Americanize it for this show. So from April 1629 to July 1695, the famous Dutch astronomer who discovered the or investigated the rings of Saturn and discovered Saturn's largest moon, Titan. But here are some other interesting facts about Christian Huygens. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Item number one. He was the first to postulate in 1678 the particle theory of light. Item number two, in 1695, he wrote a book expounding on his belief in extraterrestrial life. Item number three, he invented and patented the pendulum clock in 1657. And item number four, he designed a basic internal combustion engine fueled by gunpowder. Rebecca, go first.
Might as well, because I don't have a damn clue.
About
particle theory of light, 1678. Seems a little early, but okay. 1695, extraterrestrial life. I don't know. Why not? Sure. I know there were a lot of theories of moon people and whatnot back then. Why not have him write a whole book on it? Invented and patented the pendulum clock in 1657. That seems really late to me to be inventing a pendulum clock. But what do I know about pendulum clocks? Answer, nothing. Basic internal combustion engine fueled by gunpowder. Again, okay, why not? Sure. That's, that's well outside of what I would have thought his area of expertise is. But I don't know. I'm going with the clock thing. I don't know. You win, Steve. You win.
All right. Evan, go next.
1678, the particle theory of light. Well, this Dutchman. I mean, the Dutch in the 1600s were just the bomb in as far as, you know, Western civilization goes. They were inventing all sorts of things during this time. They were, you know, the first republic, I think, since, what, the fall of the Roman Empire, or, you know, before Rome became an empire and fell, I think, if memory serves. They were at the head of the Enlightenment in lots of ways. They did navigation. They did, seamanship. Clocks were part of what they did. Telescopes. Tons and tons of stuff. But, but there were a lot of Dutch inventors, not just Huygens. There were several. So Huygens. I don't know if Huygens, H-man, and was the particle theory of light one of them? Perhaps so. But in 1695, he wrote a book expounding on his belief in extraterrestrial life. I think that one could be true. He might have been just questioning, what if the surface of the moon had people like us on it or something to that effect. It's one thing to just, question these things. So I don't think that's a problem. The pendulum clock in 1615. I don't know if he invented it himself or maybe perfected it. He might be on to something, Rebecca. The internal combustion engine fueled by gunpowder. Nice idea, but kind of dangerous if you ask me. But I tend to think that he might have designed it. I don't know if it ever got anywhere or actually, you know, got a working model. You know, you can make a design on just about anything. So I think that one's right. I think the extraterrestrial life one is science. I think it comes down to the particle theory of light versus the clock. Yeah, I don't think he invented the clock. I think he did something to perfect it or make it more efficient, something to that effect. So I'll agree with Rebecca. That one's fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Particle theory of light, geez. It seemed like so many people kind of had that idea. It wouldn't surprise me if he did. It does seem a little early, but... yeah, that doesn't surprise me. Nothing's jumping out at me on that one. The extraterrestrial life, that, I don't know, that, sure, yeah, I could totally buy that. Kind of ringing a bell, but I can't really trust that feeling. But, so I don't have too much of a problem with that. And even the internal combustion engine, fueled by gunpowder, you know, that seems a little bit early as well to come up with that idea, but it is just a design. It's nothing beyond that. So that could be just a very, very basic. You even have the word basic in number four there. So, so that one doesn't strike me as crazy either. The one that's rubbing me the wrong way for some reason is the pendulum clock, just like Rebecca and Evan. Did he invent it? And I'm so pissed at myself because I actually looked this up like a few months ago when I was doing a news item on clockwork. So I'm kind of pissed I don't remember. So it's just rubbing me the wrong way that he invented it and patented it. I mean, what kind of patent system did they even have back then? I'm not sure, but that doesn't strike me as – I could be wrong, but that's not – I'm not feeling right about that either. So I'm just going to say that the pendulum is fiction as well.
Jay.
Woo.
Oh, boy. No pressure, Jay.
The first two are the two that bother me. The particle of light and the extraterrestrial life are the two that I'm going to talk about. First one, he was the first to postulate, 1678, the particle theory of light. That's, damn, I don't know. I'm not exactly sure. Did he make up the, was he the first to really come up with that? I don't know. And then the second one about him saying that in 95 that he believed in extraterrestrial life. That seems really early for someone to be talking about that. I was going to pick the first one, so I'm going to go with the second one and say that he didn't think of aliens that early.
Okay. You all agree that he designed a basic internal combustion engine fueled by gunpowder. And that one is science.
Yeah.
He did, in fact,
knew somebody did.
Design... Steve. A basic internal combustion engine.
Wow.
But he never managed to build it, so I did have to say design it, and it was basic. It wasn't obviously a sophisticated or later one.
Stick
and it did, you know, help later, the people who later did design and build the internal combustion engine. So
they referred to it?
Yeah, there was apparently some continuity there. So
cool.
It wasn't like Da Vinci, where he was sort of toiling by himself, and, you know, Huygens was actually engaging with the scientific community, publishing, writing books, and, you know, people knew about his ideas, and he was incredibly influential. The guy was, well, you'll see, I went to go over all the items, and I did know about the guy. I didn't realize how many things he had his fingers in. Just unbelievable.
If three quarters of these are true, it's interesting. Oh, by definition, they are.
Right. So imagine if he actually managed to build the combustion engine, maybe just...
Oh, boy.
Needed the help from an engineer or something. So let's go on to number one. You also all agree with this one. He was the first to postulate in 1678 the particle theory of light. You all think this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
What?
Damn!
This one is
fiction.
I knew it.
I knew it. I was going to say it.
Crap.
Because... he was the first one to devise the wave theory of light in 1678.
Sneaky.
Yeah, so he's the first one to come up with the idea that light travels in waves. The prevailing idea was, I don't know that there really was a prevailing idea before.
Now I hate that guy.
Yeah, he was a jerk.
He was contradicted later by Isaac Newton, who really pushed the particle theory of light, who tried to explain, like, when Newton was studying optics and refraction, all that stuff, he was using thinking of light in terms of particles, whereas Huygens made observations of birefringence.
What?
Birefringence. Doing experiments, experimenting with double refraction in Icelandic crystals, or calcite. And in order to explain his results, he came up with the notion that light is traveling in waves. And he was exactly right. You know, light does travel as waves, and that's why you do
so
get those kind of things. And of course, you know, Newton later came up with the notion that light travels as particles, and then there was, you know, research showing that photons of light, you know, do behave like particles. They, when they strike something else, when they impact with another particle. But eventually, of course, this led to quantum theory and the notion that the duality, the wave particle duality of light, it travels like a wave but then interacts like a particle. So they were both right, both Huygens and Isaac Newton were correct. So that means that in 1695, he wrote a book expounding on his belief in extraterrestrial life is science. I did not know this. Very interesting. Right before his death, this was the last thing, I think the last book that he wrote. And he had some very interesting ideas. First of all, this was, I think he maybe published this at the end of his life because it was extremely heretical to say that there is life outside of the Earth.
Yeah, I hope I have something that kick-ass to say, like I'm dying and I'm like,
aliens exist. Oh,
yeah,
right?
His book was Cosmotheros, discussed the notion of extraterrestrial life. He had an interesting idea. He thought that water was essential for life, and therefore, if there was life on other planets, there must be water on these planets as well. So he thought that the property of water varied from planet to planet. He said, if there's life on Venus, there must be water on Venus, but Venus is closer to the sun, and so the water would just evaporate away. So the water must behave differently on Venus than it does on Earth. And if there's life on Jupiter, then that water on Jupiter must, again, so that it's not frozen solid, it must behave differently on Jupiter. So kind of from a modern perspective,
Boy,
it's kind of a fanciful notion. But this is just how, you know, just thinking about how could life exist on these other bodies. And using his telescope, he made observations of Mars and Jupiter and thought he saw light and dark spots, which he interpreted as possibly being due to water. I think this was partly what led. Wasn't exactly the canals on Mars, but he did, right, interestingly, make a low-res observation of Mars and conclude water, therefore life. Interesting kind of similarity to later thought processes. Percival Lowell, later astronomer, he saw canals on Mars.
Percival Lowell.
So I thought that was interesting.
Canale.
And he said that he knew that this was heretical and was going against what is said in the Bible, although he did argue that while the Bible doesn't mention life on other planets, neither does it specifically say there isn't life on other planets. So that was his justification for that. Yeah, interesting. Extraterrestrials in 1695.
How about that?
Which means that he invented and patented the pendulum clock in 1657.
He did.
He needed a more accurate timekeeper for his astronomical observations, so he invented one. And the pendulum clock was the most accurate form of timekeeping for centuries, until I think the early 20th century. So, Jay, do you know what a horologist is?
Don't.
Come on, Steve.
Don't.
What's your mother?
Who are you talking to about
don't.
That?
Don't.
It's just somebody who studies timekeeping devices.
Horologist.
Horologist. So, Huygens
a
was...
A horoscope, of course.
Yeah, like a horoscope. A mathematician, astronomer, a physicist, and horologist. And he actually contributed to the modern form nomenclature of calculus. He was the first to describe the centripetal force. Obviously, his observations of Saturn, I think, are what he's most famous for, and invented devices like the pendulum clock. I mean, he also described the ideal pendulum, mathematically described the ideal pendulum with a massless cord, you know, that it's swinging from. Goes along with developing a timepiece based upon it. And he did do that. He did, you know, like to try to invent things based upon the underlying scientific discoveries that he made. For example, he invented He also, by the way, patented a pocket watch, and he invented a 31 tone to the octave keyboard instrument that made use of his discovery of the 31 equal temperament, which is this is part of his sound investigations.
Very cool.
He was no dummy.
No, this guy was a polymath. He was, you know, was a Renaissance man.
Brilliant. He was one of several of that time, too. I mean, he wasn't the only one inventing and creating stuff. The Dutch were incredible. You know, it was an incredible century for the Dutch.
I had fun with that one.
Yeah, I did too.
You think we'll ever pronounce his name correctly, though?
That's Christian Huygens.
Huygens. Jürgen.
No, it's wrong country. All right. Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I have a quote from another Renaissance man named Bertrand Russell.
Perhaps the most quotable man on this show.
You guys heard that, right? Birdie?
Sure. Yeah, every fifth show we quote him, apparently.
I can't help it. I keep stumbling across these phenomenal quotes from the man.
And forgetting that you've used them before.
It's very likely that I've said this one before, but it's so good, I'm going to say it again. This was sent in by a listener named Stephen Rogers. This was a quote of Bertrand's from the book he wrote called The ABC of Relativity.
Right.
And the quote is, "Science does not aim at establishing immutable truths and eternal dogmas. Its aim is to approach the truth by successive approximations, without claiming that at any stage, final and complete accuracy has been achieved." Thank you, Bertrand, for putting that so eloquently and so precisely.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And Russell.
Word.
Good job.
Mr. Russell.
His rap name would be B. Russ.
B.
Big B. Russ.
B. Russ.
Bertrand Russell!
So, guys, we have TAM coming up. That's July 12th. And at TAM this year, we're doing a poker tournament on Saturday night, and you can pre-register for that by going to skepticspoker@gmail.com. Send me your name and make sure I have your current email address, and we'll be in touch with you about the details.
I understand, Jay. Jesus. This isn't actually the first TAM poker event.
Yeah, I think that there has been six other Thursday night poker events that people were having before TAM. And
wow.
The organizers of that are not going to be there this year from what I've come to find out today.
Yeah, this is the first one the SGU is going to make awesome.
Yeah, we're bringing in other skeptics that are going to come in and sit at the tables, and we have prizes, and we're doing our own version of this. You know, please do email us, let us know that you're coming Saturday night at 11 o'clock.
All right, thanks, Jay. And thank you all for joining me again this week.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. Surely.
Thanks, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.